The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. And I know for a long time I've been dealing both with the question of Ukrainian nationalism and its tradition over the centuries. And I think I've given my listeners a fairly detailed analysis of that very important phenomenon. And one of my big areas as a writer is small state nationalism, and it's my position that nationalism that arises in small states that have been subject of occupation, like Ukraine and Ireland, develop a very different sort of nationalism than what develops in larger states that have empires like Russia or Great Britain. And so I'm going to switch gears here and deal with another area of interest to me, and that is Ireland, and especially medieval Ireland, both pre-Norman and post-Norman. I am an Irishman, I'm an Irish patriot, and as an Orthodox person, I think I can have somewhat of a more balanced view of the Irish-English battles over the centuries, because I, although I generally sympathize with the native Gaels, from which I descend, from the Gannon family of County Longford, the very end of the Shannon River, I think I can be a bit more objective between the battles of the Church of England and the Church of and the Catholic Church of Ireland. So I guess I want to come from this from an old Catholic position, and by old Catholic I simply mean that Western patristic priestism mentality, both liturgical and theological, that is to say, the Western Church, the Church of the Western Patristic Fathers like Vincent and Ambrose prior to the Schism of 1054, which is really the only rational definition of Old Catholic. And I think that this is something that, that Ireland in its insular period manifests more than anybody else, because they developed a way of thought in a way of church organization which was very healthy and produced for, you know, a handful of people thousands of great ascetics and saints. And in the early Middle Ages in the Western world, Ireland was the most literate. It was probably the only place outside of Aquitaine that knew the Greek language. It really was the repository of the ancient wisdom of North Africa and the Greek Middle East, and it was by far the best educated and the most advanced of the European peoples. And it should be made clear that the invasion of Ireland, at least, you know, the early years, the time of Henry II of Britain, that was a gift given to Henry by Pope Hadrian, of course, was an Englishman. And so the use of the fraudulent donation of Constantine to give Ireland to the British, that was something that was given papal permission. And, of course, even the invasion of England by William the Bastard was something, again, that came into existence because of papal interference in the politics of Western Europe. So both the Norman invasion of England and then the Norman invasion via Britain to Ireland were both sanctioned by the Pope with the understanding that these new colonial governments will very tightly bind these countries to the papacy. And the fact that that was resisted by the ancient Gaels suggests that the church was not a Roman Catholic church, in a sense we use the phrase today, but an old Catholic church based on the ancient patristic consensus. And as far as the Celtic Church organization, I think it's something worth discussing. It's worth discussing for, among other reasons, it shows a sort of social development that flowered, a high level of literacy and technical and medical expertise outside of the Roman Empire. It should be noted that early medieval Ireland, there were a long-lived people. They had a highly advanced medicine and literary, medical and literary establishment, and this should not be ignored. Western Europe was largely converted by Irish monastics, or I should say reconverted by Irish monastics, and even Britain. The great British saints in Northern Europe were trained by Irish monastics. So this is something that's absolutely central in Western European history, something very important to me, and the Irish presence in America is such that it's something that deserves greater discussion. The fact is that when you deal with Russian history, the specific Ukrainian idea is ignored, and that's a problem. When you deal with the history of the Western Middle Ages, you deal with Gaul and you deal with parts of Germany, and often you deal with England and North Italy, often Ireland gets ignored or only gets a few paragraphs. And that's the case for most of the major medievalists who are operating today. So, what I want to do this evening is I want to give a thumbnail sketch of what I think the most important elements in medieval Irish life and why it's significant from an Orthodox Old Catholic point of view. When I'm not dealing with Russian and Ukrainian stuff, I'm dealing with Irish stuff because of my background and because of my grandmother was a Gaelic speaker from Longford. And she taught me quite a bit over the years in her, you know, very, very simple way. She died many years ago. She was almost 100 and she died in 1987. And she's the one who got me started on this. And it's significant because there was a tremendous stress on nationalism and social justice, even in early medieval Ireland. And I want to make it very clear that there was a strong ethnic connection amongst the Gaelic clans in early medieval Ireland, and that is proven in their confrontations with the Normans later on. The Gaels were highly conscious of their linguistic and ethnic differences from the rest of Europe. And in many cases, even when St. Columbanus went to Gaul, you know, he found such ignorance due to the political, I mean, obviously the political insanity of the Merovingian era. He had to teach them in somewhat of a condescending way how to speak proper Latin, how to speak and read proper Greek, because very few people on the continent in Western Europe at the time knew how to speak Latin and Greek. Well, they thought they were speaking Latin, but in fact it was sort of like a proto-French or a proto-Italian. And Columbanus and the monastery of Bobbio and elsewhere, these were the men who kind of resurrected and reimposed a real Roman Latin culture and to a lesser extent a Greek culture onto Western Europe. And so the patristic understanding of the ancient Orthodox and Old Catholic Church of the West was brought to the continent by Ireland. I also want to say something else. As an Irishman and as an Irish patriot, I don't want anyone to mistake my intentions, somehow condemning everything that is English, or I should say Anglo-Norman. It's no different than my understanding of the relationship between Kiev and Moscow. All four cultures are worthwhile. All four cultures are equal in my mind. They have different strengths and weaknesses. All four cultures, however, in order to remain legitimate, need to stay on their own territory. The only time when I become anti-British is when the great culture of the Englishman becomes an empire, or the great culture of the Russian becomes an empire. And then that culture changes. That culture develops concepts that justify the colonial empire. And that's when a good and legitimate and holy culture, both the Anglo-Saxons and the Russians, becomes perverse. Early Irish law in the early Middle Ages is what most of us know as the Breen Laws. A Breen is essentially a legal personage, highly literate. In order to become a Breen, you have to go through a substantial legal training, both in Gaelic and in Latin. And, you know, this is at a time where all of these institutions had collapsed throughout Western Europe. The Breen laws were those that were fully universal in the Irish mind. Although there was no sense of political unity, nor were there any desire for political unity in the insular period, there certainly was a linguistic and cultural unity, which is far more important. And here you have an example where the law code, rather than the state, the law code enforced strictly on the local level became the unifying element on the island. And that, of course, was through the influence of St. Patrick combined with the ancient old Catholic faith of the West. And then was, you know, formed a far broader and more detailed Breen laws or Breen law code. So you have a hostility to any concept of centralization in the early Irish mind. It's, and I've said this many times, that the academic establishment as always is wrong when they deal with the concept of nationalism because they define it in such a way that it becomes a straw man for them to attack. And their definition of nationalism usually is the politicization of an ethnic group within state borders. The implication being that the state creates the ethnicity, not the other way around. And of course, that's false. Ethnic groups have always existed. Whether or not they're politicized is unimportant. Nationalism has to do with the language, and language traditionally is defined in a far broader sense than just words that we use, but all of our customs and the way that we act and things that we kind of take for granted on a day-to-day basis. That's what we really mean by a language. It's far broader than just words and grammar. So in insular Ireland, in the early Middle Ages, what we're talking about is a highly developed intellectual ethnic tradition on the island itself. That is the nation. The state is an irrelevancy. I simply don't care. The state will use and manipulate the ethnic tradition for its own purposes and will pervert the ethnic tradition for its own purposes and will then invent histories that then justify the expansion of the state at the expense of the ethnic groups. And in many ways, the centralized state is in fact a mini-empire, because it often needs to impose itself and tax and regulate and manipulate many of the regional sub-ethnic groups that make up the country. And that was, I think, most blatant in France, in the development of the French central state, which repressed the Gaels living in places like Brittany and forced them to speak this kind of half-Latin, half-German melange that we call French. So we're talking about Gaelic nationalism being legal, literate, and cultural. The state was and is a necessary evil. But as far as the law itself is concerned, the clan is central. Like all healthy societies, it is not the individual but the family that is the only natural basis of society. Families join into clans, and clans join into what we call a sept or a tuat. A tuat has the lowest level of king who is elected and rules with an elective council. The fertile land within the tuat is either given a small piece of it given to the monarch for his own purposes, so there's really no need for taxation. It is owned through private ownership. It is owned through tenantry, where you pay a certain rent, usually back then a very small rent. And, of course, common land, which was the bulk of the land, which was owned by the clan or the sept, collectively speaking. And because you had this great linguistic and cultural unity, there wasn't the kind of tragedy of the commons that you find elsewhere. And so the Insular Ireland shows how important this kind of cultural and linguistic unity is in the broad sense. Because only then can you have things like common lands. And really, your lower level Irishmen at the time, these were what we call the unfree tenants. They had no herds of their own, and really the herd of sheep or cattle is just as important as land as a unit of analysis and income here, but essentially was forwarded a herd and a plot of land by the leader of the sept, and then it became a client of that leader and had to pay a certain rent. And really the lowest of the unfree tenants essentially served in the household and served both the military and legal needs of the Tuat monarch. But that's not to imply that in any way you had any kind of feudalism. You had a great degree of legal equality. You had a great degree of economic equality. And something that the law code lays out is that every Tuatha has to have what is essentially an open public house, where at the expense of the local monarch, a public house with food and ale had to be open at all times for travelers, everything free of charge. And that is, and there has to be, I mean, the law code lays out, there has to be a certain amount of food available. There has to be a certain amount of ale available for people who need it, especially travelers. And any necessity concerning handicraft, concerning artisan work, concerning poor relief and education was done at the monastic city. There were no cities in Insular Ireland, but the monastic complex became so large that it became, in essence, the economic, cultural, traditional center of the Tuath, and even beyond the borders of the Tuath on the island. So that's the thumbnail sketch of the social system. It was extremely fair. Everything was elective, including on the monastic level. Bishops did not rule. Bishops essentially were under the control of the abbot of the monastery and were generally only used for ordinations. So it was a conciliar form of church government rather than the episcopal form of church government. And this is something that irritated the Roman See. But it's also extremely important to know that this is part of the ancient Irish patristic understanding. It produced thousands of saints and the most literate monastic culture in Europe at the time, whether it be Eastern or Western. And this was Ireland's great contribution to the history and intellectual development of Western Europe. So what you had at the base of the social system was the concept of clientelism. The idea of the so-called free and base client, the free client being a large proportion of the population, fairly high rank, substantial legal power, and they served the man above him for 7 years and had to pay any loans back within that period of time, but of course kept all the usufruct of the land, that is to say the produce and the profit of the land, for himself. The base client was also free, but was of a lower rank and had to pay higher taxes to the elected council of the Tuath. And really, you're only, you know, your serfs and slaves, you know, your slaves were usually POWs, which was typical in Western Europe. And the serf was someone who could be a foreigner, it could be a criminal. Of course, there's no prisons or death penalty in early medieval Ireland. The law code only provides for the erc, or the a fine, and the fine is determined by the rank of the person who has been offended. And that certainly is no different than as now. So you had, like any society, you had a hierarchy. It was a hierarchy of legal rights. But as a matter of course, you had a general equality of condition within the sept organization. And I say equality of condition in the sense that although you had this hierarchy, it was never a rigid hierarchy. There was always room for mobility, and it was a highly mobile society. And I think the monasteries had a lot to do with that, because in going to a monastery, you became very quickly literate in Gaelic, Latin, and Greek, and really had mastered much of the classical heritage that the Irish, almost by themselves, had maintained on the island. This will be destroyed by the Anglo-Norman attack, not necessarily at the time of Henry II, but certainly after him. And at the time of Elizabeth I, all of these records were burned and destroyed, with the explicit understanding that, and this is, Elizabeth was not at all shy about speaking her mind here. What she's doing is destroying any connection, the Irish mind, with this insular past, and forcing upon it an Anglo-Norman identity. And so Elizabeth I is, it just shows you the arbitrary nature of you know, human rights and ethics in the West, in that she was, in her official capacity, in her orders to her lieutenants in Ireland, a true believer in genocide and the mass destruction, the mass confiscation of land from what was left at that time of your initial Gaelic people on the island. So much of this tradition has been destroyed and burned by a deliberate policy, not merely from Elizabeth I, although Elizabeth was the most enthusiastic about this kind of policy. This tradition was vitiated not so much by the British, but by the Vikings. And the Vikings, or the Danes, or the Norsemen, whatever you want to call them, did invade and occupy large portions of the island, no different than they did in the time prior to Alfred in Anglo-Saxon England. But the Vikings, very much like your initial Anglo-Norman settlers, became quite Irish, and I want to hold that the victories, the Clontarf under Brian Boru, I mean, you know, he had as many Vikings on his side as he was fighting against. So, I want to hold that as the centuries went on, and the early Middle Ages became the middle period of the Middle Ages, the government in Ireland was forced to become more and more centralized. The High King of Tara actually had some real purpose and power, and Boru showed why that was the case, namely that we need to organize ourselves against the Vikings. And although I have to say that this was never done, after the death of Brian and Malachy, there was mass chaos on the island, which is one of the things that led to the Anglo-Norman invasion in the first place. But it has to be made clear that the Gaels, in all of their battles against the Anglo-Norman occupation, they never maintained that unity that Brian had created. And I know I'm skipping around here quite a bit, but I'm giving you kind of the thumbnail sketch. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the initial contacts with the Anglo-Normans.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
All right, welcome back. We have shifted gears a bit from what we normally deal with on this show, and we are dealing with early medieval Ireland as well as the middle period, in the invasion of Henry II at the invitation, both at certain disaffected Irish chiefs, as well as the explicit demand of the Pope that Ireland be subdued, because the Pope, well, there were several issues here. Pope Hadrian was told that these Irishmen were insane, that they were savages, that they were heretics, that they were not in communion with the Pope of Rome, that they kind of did their own thing. And the Pope saw a certain level of benefit to come from this, and then through the authority of the donation of Constantine, gave Henry II permission to invade and occupy the island. The irony, one of the great ironies of Irish history, is that the invasion under Henry II was done, at least in the official reason, that the Irish were not Catholic enough. They were not papal enough. The assaults on Ireland by Henry VIII and Elizabeth were based on the official theory that the Irish were too Catholic and too papal. And in both cases, the conclusion was that the Irish were savages and that the Irish needed to be wiped out. And so in one case, they were not Catholic enough. In the other case, they were too Catholic. And in both cases, the conclusion was that they're savages. And I think that there's still quite a bit of English bias in that regard concerning the nature of the Gael. The Gael really isn't European. The Gael really isn't white. He is a savage. And it should be made clear that during the time of one of the most evil men of all history, Oliver Cromwell, when he invaded Ireland, claiming that he was very much a follower of King David and in the Old Testament, they gave themselves Hebrew names and everything else, they wiped out as many of the Irish population as they can get a hold of. And the remainder that they can get a hold of were sold into slavery in the Caribbean. And so the Irish were slaves in the chattel slaves in Barbados and the sugar plantations, even before the African was. And so it should be made clear that here you have an example of the Irish not being considered fully human and not being considered Europeans, not being considered Christians. And Oliver Cromwell starting this trend of enslaving the Irishmen in the Caribbean. And then, of course, the penal laws, which we'll probably deal with some other time, was essentially a form of chattel slavery right there in their own country. And so not only is Oliver Cromwell and, you know, even people like Elizabeth considered the scions of the Enlightenment, their genocide is generally only condemned by those who have an interest and knowledge of Irish history. And when I used to teach at Mount St. Mary's, I taught quite a bit of Irish and medieval history, and I was known for that about as much as I was known for the Russian and Ukrainian stuff, although there's clearly a connection, I think, between Ukraine and Ireland and the question of colonialism, and so they are unified in that regard. I called this part of European history the other side of the Enlightenment. And just as Russian development in the 19th century to a great extent came from the exploitation of Ukrainian land and labor, and that continued into the Soviet era, much of the British power in the early Enlightenment came from the slavery and confiscations and settlement of Ireland at that particular period of time. So as the Enlightenment speaks of the universal liberty and universal equality and universal justice, this is done at the same time much of the world is being colonized and exploited by these very same people, starting with Ireland. So the exoteric concept of the Enlightenment, and then there's the esoteric concept of the Enlightenment. in the occult doctrine that was so important to John Dee in the Elizabethan era, coming from the rabbis of Prague, of whom John Dee was a student, everything has a shadow. And the British Empire, which was supposed to be this torch of liberty and progress and enlightenment, was done, at least in part, based on slavery of the Irishman as well as the African, and this kind of slavery and confiscation and starvation and genocide tactics were the shadow of the Enlightenment. And you can't talk about the Enlightenment and the development of the British Empire and the development of the scientific and then the Industrial Revolution, which came precisely from British and Dutch sources. You can't separate that from slavery and colonization. Every bit of technological stuff that we use, that I use, came at a massive human cost. Because the Enlightenment was based to a great extent on mass warfare, mass armies, the growth of the centralized state, slavery, and colonialism. And the question is would any of this have developed had these countries, which we now call the Third World, Ireland certainly being a part of it, at least in the countryside, were not exploited and dominated for the benefit of a tiny elite in the cities. Okay. Henry II, without getting into the details of people like Strongbow and McMurrow and everybody else that sort of invited this Anglo-Norman assistance to deal with the chaos in the post-Brian era, many of the local chiefs did submit to the Anglo-Norman attack. The Norman mentality, the Norman military and political organization was far superior to anything that the Gaels could muster, especially in that period of time. And by the time Henry got around to controlling his nobles in the eastern part of the island, he had brought a large Norman force with him. And yet, many of the eastern and northern chiefs kind of treated Henry just as another Territe high king. And Henry was able to use this kind of Norman splendor to wow the far simpler Gaelic population. And Hugh de Lacy was Henry's ambassador on the island. And he appointed sheriffs for this kind of new local organization that was to replace the Brian system with what we call normally Western European feudalism. And Henry, partially because he really didn't know anything else, partially because he needed to reward his friends, introduced Western-style Norman feudalism to Ireland, which, of course, had never known it before. And so what you ended up having, you know, in the eastern half, was this strange mix of Norman feudal law and the remnants of the Brian law. But I want to impress on you, from the point of view of political theory, that this was Ireland's introduction to what we now call progress. The Irish population, especially the Gaelic population and later on the Old English population, were treated as chattel because for the Enlightenment and the Empire to function, for the scientific revolution to function, there needs to be this hinterland of people to exploit and manipulate what is essentially human raw material. That the industrial and scientific revolutions are about this Kabbalistic tikkun olam, the fixing, the alteration of nature for this urban elite. Tikkun olam is absolutely a central Kabbalistic and Judaic concept from which to understand modernity, to understand the scientific and technological revolution. And I know Michael Hoffman has spent a lot of time worrying about this concept, but the idea of tikkun olam is behind the concept of revolution. And we will deal with this relative to the English, the French, and then the Russian Revolution, all three of which had a strong Jewish component. But more importantly, the theology of revolution comes from the idea that the Jews collectively view themselves as God, or having God's essence, a divine spark, which only Jewish souls have, and they, as a collectivity, will remake the world in their own image. This is the theological concept of the revolution, and we'll deal with this some other time in more detail. But Tikkun Olam also views the Gentile as not having souls, and not having this divine spark, and therefore can be used under certain circumstances, and this was the case in Britain, France, and in Russia, as simply human chattel, raw material, to be used and manipulated by the elite, who, at least in Kabbalistic theology, the Jews are collectively deity. But in a sense, that has to be connected with the exploitation of Ireland in the Elizabethan era and its production of the Enlightenment. And that is identical with Peter the First's exploitation of Russia and Ukraine, especially in the creation of his Enlightenment in the centralized state in St. Petersburg. Both come from the exact same mentality. Both are deeply Masonic. And both seek to create enlightenment and a technological paradise, but there is a shadow to this paradise, and that is the fact that a huge portion of the goyim have to be used as chattel. And as far as Peter, who was initiated into the Masonic Lodge in Amsterdam, was concerned, it was the peasants, and especially the Ukrainian Cossacks. And in Elizabeth and John Dee's case, it was the poor Englishmen in the city, as well as, most importantly and most violently, the Irish. King John, the famous, of course, King John in Ireland, was universally hated. He hated his own people, and he hated the Irish especially. And really, the Anglo-Irish in Ireland began to mobilize their forces against Henry II's son in this particular case, and his son will eventually go over to King John. And this is where you get the Geraldine movement. The Geraldine movement is essentially the Celtic Normans. These are the descendants, what we call the Old English. These are the descendants of the initial settlers living on the island who became Irish. They were aware of their differences, but they definitely sympathized in a general sense with the Gaelic customs and tradition of the island. And the Anglo-Norman Irish patriots, which served the Geraldines and then the Southern Geraldines, the Desmonds, and this was sort of the familial core that created many of the early rebellions against British rule. And then, as is well known, the O'Neills, who are the traditional monarch, the royal family in Ulster, had approached Robert Bruce in Scotland, who, of course, had won substantial victories against Britain. And because the Scots are ethnically related to the Irish, Robert Bruce's attack on Ireland was tremendous. He essentially defeated all comers. He energized the Geraldine Old English and Gaelic cause. The problem is that the battles between the English lieutenants in Ireland and Robert Bruce was genocidal. I mean, it was based around terror tactics. And I want to say that both Bruce and many of the Geraldines, as well as the English, used terror tactics as a normal aspect of military organization. And I mean the murder of women and children. I mean public torture. I mean the burning of fields, the burning of food stores, things like throwing dead bodies into a city so that it would grow diseases, the use of starvation to force people to surrender. These kind of tactics were used from here on in these Irish wars. And although Robert Bruce did quite a bit of damage to British interests in Ireland, and to a great extent mobilized and energized both the Old English and the Gaelic resistance, it was done at a huge cost. It was done at a huge cost. And people like Richard de Burgh, who served as the English lieutenants in Ireland, although fairly talented militarily, could not defeat the Bruce's forces, largely because not only of his own military ability, his experienced veterans that he was using, which, you know, this is something that in the Williamite Wars, you know, William had these forces that were experienced and intelligent and well-trained with first-class British and Dutch equipment, and here they are fighting an Irish force under James that, you know, that was very poorly equipped. Nevertheless, Robert the Bruce created something, and he created sort of the Celtic Norman nation. He created sort of a Gaelic Old English unity, which was generally Old Catholic in their approach to theology, anti-English in the sense of English being an empire, and generally quite competent in the field. But Robert did involve the Old English and the Geraldine movement in pillaging, in these terror tactics used to respond to the identical tactics from people like de Burgh and others in Ireland. And so, regardless of the fact that Bruce will eventually be assassinated in the middle of a battle, he will be killed, and once he dies, the Geraldine cause is largely lost. But to a great extent, at least at the time, it was a Pyrrhic victory for the British. And the Irish suffered, I think, more than anybody else. The Gaels and the Old English suffered tremendously because not only was there a massive loss of life, because this was a particularly nasty and bitter war, this war went after infrastructure. It went after the peasantry. It did these things that, you know, we don't accept today, but were considered a normal part of warfare. Now, the creation of this Old English Gaelic nation was a huge historical alteration. The Gaels were no longer this kind of separate ethnic institution. They had substantially intermixed and sympathized with what we now call the Old English, creating a relatively compact and unified new ethnic group. An ethnic group based on similarity of language and customs, because these Old English had become Irishmen. And this is why the statutes of Kilkenny were drafted. This was the Anglo-Norman response to the Old English and to the Bruce invasion. And that's the idea that under no circumstances can Anglo-Normans marry Irishmen. There can be no intellectual or economic intercourse with the Gaels, and there is no mixing even of the clerical and monastic institutions between Gaels and the Anglo-Normans. So here again, you have more evidence that the Irish were not considered European, that they were considered somewhat savage and subhuman. And so, as the middle part of the medieval world in Ireland becomes the High Middle Ages, you have a highly stratified society. The Anglo-Normans living in the Pale, that area around Dublin, which is a city founded by the Vikings, and they had their own parliament in which the Old English. The Old English in general were not permitted to sit. And then after the Reformation, no Catholic was permitted to sit there. And so really the final act in this drama that we're going to deal with is the landing of Richard II in Ireland, 1394. Now we're at the end of the High Middle Ages, finally landing in Ireland with a massive force, and for the first time really saw a substantial confederation. The O'Neills, the O'Connors, the O'Briens, the traditional leaders of the old Gaelic Tuatha finally coming together and fighting this English invasion. But Richard II, you know, rather than fighting them openly, which was very, very dangerous, simply bought them off. And it's true that eventually the O'Tooles and the O'Nolans and McMurrah, they destroy the Royal Army eventually. What people like Richard did, and what will be perfected under Henry VIII and Elizabeth, is the exact same thing that the Russian Empire did relative to Ukraine. They went to the upper classes, they went to the landowners, and said, we will give you a full English Norman title, defensible by Anglo-Norman weaponry, the guarantee of your safety, and a guarantee of your class and noble status in exchange for your loyalty. And people like the O'Connors and the O'Briens accepted this. And they became, essentially, although of Irish extraction, they became Norman lords in Ireland. And Catherine the Great did this exact same thing in Ukraine by going to the Cossack landowners and saying, we will give you your land and serfs. We'll give you a new Russian title, and your lands are defensible now with Russian arms. You will be fully secure in your privileges and power. And in both Ukraine and in Ireland, it was a deadly combination. It worked. It worked everywhere. And it's something that I've been arguing my whole adult life. I argued it in my book on medieval Russia. I argued it in the Third Rome. I argued it in my book on Serbia, that the nobility of any country, the upper level landowners, will do anything, say anything, and be anything in order to keep their lands and their incomes and their power. And all Catherine in Russia did, or Richard, or later Elizabeth did in Britain, they did the exact same thing. They played on the class divisions within the population. And the Russian occupation of Ukraine and the British occupation of Ireland was not so much one with weaponry. There were too many Irish victories against the British for that to be the case. It was won because they went to the nobility. The nobility, traditionally the weakest link in any country. An oligarchy of land and power that will sell out their own mothers, and in this case quite literally, for the sake of having this now new guarantee from a strong centralized state of their lands, serfs, and property. Essentially, they're given serfs in Ukraine and in Ireland for the very first time. And they're given these serfs as essentially slave labor, Gaels, of course, or Ukrainians in Ukraine. They're given these serfs and full title over them in exchange for loyalty to the system. So at the time of Richard's massive invasion, and it's true that Richard, you know, was not used to the terrain. And the Ireland is very difficult to fight in, and I think that had a lot to do with a lot of the Irish victories and the creation of the Irish Parliament, which is a highly irregular and non-representative body. This was essentially the Norman response to the Geraldine movement and this new so-called Hiberno-Norman nation that is created. Old Catholic nationalist, in essence, sort of the neo-Gaelic ethnic movement in the country. The Pale, Statutes of Kilkenny, and then eventually, after Charles I is overthrown, open slavery, the penal laws, and total confiscation of land from what was left of either the Gaels or the Hiberno-Norman neo-Gaels, that will complete at least the more violent elements of the genocide of Ireland. But I want to stress again and again, this was done because some of the elite families accepted London's offer of serfs and land and a British title in exchange for loyalty. And this is why nationalism is so important, because nationalism either ignores class distinctions or, in I think a more constructive way, seeks to minimize class distinctions in the interest of an ethnic and linguistic and religious fraternity, brotherhood, solidarity. And this sort of policy proves how when this solidarity is torn asunder, the solidarity that you did have in the insular period in Ireland, when it's torn asunder through the influence of feudalism, whether medieval or modern, our current neo-feudalist economic system, when you do this, when that solidarity is torn down, there is no tyranny that the upper-level nobles will not accept in exchange, of course, for full title to their land and serfs, however you define that. And I know that in this talk, I've kind of gone all over the place and I've been a little chaotic, but I'm trying to cram in a lot of issues, into a fairly short period of time. And, we are going to continue on this topic for a while because it's something of great interest to Orthodox and as well as Old Catholics and those who are both Orthodox and Old Catholic. And a true nationalist and ruralist rebellion that developed in Ireland, and how significant, especially in the insular early medieval period, the Irish were to the development of civilization in Western Europe. And so we're going to end here for now, and I will talk to you next time. We will continue on topics like this and similar topics as we take a break from our normal Russian and Ukrainian stuff and move on to things that are not entirely dissimilar, as I think we've already shown. And I appreciate you listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.